Hello, I'm Nigel, and welcome to the Crew of Japan podcast, a weekly podcast where we take you on audio journeys through Japanese culture. Welcome back to the Crew of Japan. Today we are so excited to discuss a travel destination that's been on all of our to-do list for a while now, and what we believe is probably one of the most beautiful and peaceful places to visit in all of Japan. That's right, today we're talking about Hokkaido. In this episode, you will not only learn our thoughts on the prefecture, but we're joined by Kay Allen from Japan Travel, also known as the Japan National Tourism Organization, who appeared as a guest on our podcast before in season one. With her help, we will embark on a journey into Hokkaido's incredible nature and history, which you should visit on your next trip to Japan, and the essential tips and tricks you must know before going. After listening to this episode, you should have everything you need to begin planning a trip to Hokkaido. Let's jump right into it.
All right, and we are back with another travel episode. I'm super excited. Hokkaido is a really amazing place, and it's definitely on my bucket list. I think it's on all of our bucket lists. But today, I am joined with my crew, Doug, Nigel. What's up?
Not too much. Chilling, having a beer.
Same here. Without the beer, but
without
same
the beer.
Here. Yes.
Oh, but it's been a long day.
Hasn't it? But today, I'm excited because we actually have a guest with us from season one, Kay with Travel Japan, or also known as Japan National Tourism Organization. Hi, Kay. Thank you for coming on with us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. We really enjoyed our discussion about just Japan travel, and we were like, you know what, we have the travel bug, we really are itching to travel, and we're sure many of our listeners are as well. So we're like, you know what, let's just go into like deep dives of like all these different places in Japan that we can explore. And we're excited to have you here for the Hokkaido episode. So thank you so much for coming.
No, thank you. I love it. That is one of my favorite ways to travel through Japan, is doing those deep off the beaten path dives, as you would say. And I'm excited to tell you more about Hokkaido.
Well, before we get into the meat of the episode, I do want to pose a question for my crew. Guys, so, you know, none of us have been to Hokkaido yet before. But it's on our bucket list. So
that's a strong yet.
I know. Yes. That's definitely on your to-do list. I know. But so before Kay kind of gives us the scoop on Hokkaido, what are y'all's impressions of Hokkaido?
Cold.
Yeah. Cold. Yeah. Snow, beer, and nature.
Okay, good.
Dairy. I think dairy is pretty big up in Hokkaido as well. I've had a couple opportunities to go, and I unfortunately, when I was on JET, there's a annual trip to the snow festival. They would take a ferry from Fukushima from Sendai to Sapporo. And it always lined up with the Super Bowl weekend. So I always would have a weekend when I go to my friend's house, and we would make a big weekend out of the Super Bowl. So unfortunately could never, I chose football over cultural experiences. So
how dare you, Doug.
Stereotypical American of me. I know. American football. I just want to clarify that for our international audience. American football. Okay. Not soccer.
That's even worse.
I know.
Yeah, no,
but Tom Brady did lose. He did lose to the Giants that year. I remember that was a good one.
We are not a football podcast over here. But anyway. So I don't know, like I kind of line up with Nigel's actually. Oh, wow. Yeah, like the first thing I think about when I think Hokkaido is like nature, because I like watch a lot of NHK World on the internet, and they have those like NHK like documentaries, and a lot of them are nature in Hokkaido, and I get to see like how like winter to spring is formed. And I don't know, I don't like the cold. So yeah, I agree. Like I think of snow and cold. That's why I would want to visit in the summer whenever I could, because I'm a wuss. But other than that, it's still on my like very much to-do list. But Kay, our question for you, kind of to really give us a deeper look at Hokkaido, is like, what is your travel experience within Hokkaido Prefecture? Like, where have you been? What have you done? And what's your impressions of Hokkaido?
Sure. And I think you guys aren't very far off, because Hokkaido does have a lot of really incredible nature. It is very well known for dairy. I think Doug mentioned that. And I've been to Hokkaido a few times now for different reasons. And every time I go, it's a completely different experience. But I think Hokkaido has a lot of different faces. There's definitely some city kind of nightlife atmosphere alongside the nature. It's definitely a snowy destination during the wintertime, with really, really great skiing. And they did previously host the Winter Olympics. So it is very well known for that. I personally have been to several different places, Sapporo being one of them, which I think a lot of people will go to Hokkaido through the Sapporo Gateway. It's probably the easiest way to reach Hokkaido. It's about a 90-minute flight from Tokyo. So a lot of people go through New Chitose Airport. And I really, really like the atmosphere in Sapporo. It's got kind of like an artsy, yet fun shopping nightlife kind of vibe to it. You know, you've got that lively Susukino area in Sapporo. And lots of shopping. There's great art museums. So I had a lot of fun in Sapporo. I also really enjoy Otaru, which is another area that I've gotten to travel to. And that's just to the west of Sapporo, not far. By train, I think it's about like 30 minutes to 45 minutes. And that's another kind of like totally different vibe to Hokkaido. It has this kind of red brick and ivy and canals and this kind of like, I don't know, sort of like Victorian kind of a feel to it. It's real weird. But they are really famous for doing glass work. So like stained glass. And there's some museums there that specialize in stained glass, and they're really spectacular. Another area I've visited is not far from there, called Yoichi, and that's where you can find the Nikka Whiskey Distillery, which I highly, highly recommend. That's one of the first kind of introductions to whiskey in Japan. The man who started Nikka Whiskey Distillery actually moved to Scotland and studied Scottish whiskey distilling, and then brought that back along with a wife to Japan. And they actually ended up making a live action drama about their romance and whiskey making in Japan. It's very popular in Japan.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So that's a really fun whiskey distillery to visit. They have a great tasting room. And then some of the other places were more nature-based. So Onuma and the Onuma Quasi-National Park, I've been able to visit, which is really, really beautiful, great for kayaking. There's, I believe, some campgrounds as well. And not far from there is the Shikotsu Toya National Park, and I've visited Lake Toya. And Hakodate is another. I've been to a lot of Hokkaido. Hakodate to the south is another great place to visit in Hokkaido. And this also is one of the first ports to open up to trading with the Western world. So it has, I think it reminds me a lot of San Francisco. the way that it looks. There's a lot of kind of like steep hills and cable cars and like Victorian style houses, like that Victorian architecture. It's really strange, but it really does look a lot like San Francisco. And then it's right on, you know, the water. So you have that kind of Bay Area feel as well. And complete with like fog rolling in, like it's very, it's very San Francisco, but they've got just the cutest little morning markets where you can, you know, go see the fish markets and try, you know, fresh sashimi, and they sell soft serve there, which of course Hokkaido's dairy is kind of second to none in Japan. So yeah, that's just a few of the places that I've been to, but I love it every time I go.
A few.
That's more than I was
the official travel ambassador of Hokkaido.
I gotta tell you, I love it.
Wow, yeah, Hakodate is, that's one of the places I really would love to go to as well. I've heard, you know, obviously I've never been, but I've read that there are perhaps, I don't know if it's like official, but there are more Meiji and Taisho era like buildings and architecture in Hakodate than perhaps any other place in Japan. So that's one of the top on my list. I'm really excited to know that you enjoyed it and your time there.
Yeah, no, that kind of tracks because you have, of course, Goryeokaku, which was a Meiji era fort. And yeah, that was one of the last kind of battlegrounds. I think it's... was it 1869 probably was, you know, the heat of the conflict in that area. So after, of course, everything settled, it became a park that was just open to the public and is really beautiful during cherry blossom season. But yeah, I can totally see why that would have the most. The architecture is definitely impressive. And then if you go to the Goryeokaku Tower, you can see the fort, which is a five-pointed star shaped fort from that tower, and it's stunning, a stunning piece of architecture for sure.
So it sounds like Hokkaido is pretty diverse, like in like just every aspect, honestly.
Oh, definitely.
What's the furthest north you've been in Hokkaido?
Furthest north,
not to put you on the spot.
Yeah, no, you know, I haven't been as far as like some of the, like, I think the farthest point is Wakanai, but I have probably the furthest I've been is gonna be like Otaru or Yoichi. They're right on the water there. I haven't gone further north than that, though I would love to very much.
Yeah, you just gotta make sure you go in the summer, right?
Yeah, well, you could, I mean, you could go east and, you know, do the... ice float walking. It's very, very interesting out there. And I think that's the, oh God, I'm totally blanking on the name right now. It'll come to me. Give me 2 seconds. Shiratoko Peninsula. There we go. You do the Shiratoko Peninsula.
You weren't kidding. That was 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go, northeasterly, then you have the Shiratoko Peninsula, and they do these really impressive tours of the ice floats up there. So you could go in the wintertime and still have a really incredible time on one of those guided tours. Definitely do the guided tour, though. Don't try to go out there by yourself.
Yeah. So, you know, what do you, let's kind of dip more into your opinion here. What do you think makes Hokkaido special enough? Like, what about it is really something that made it become a travel destination for Japan? Like, you mentioned the Olympics had taken place there. Is that maybe some of the allure of traveling there was maybe residual from those Olympics? Is that kind of when the tourist boom, or is it mostly, I mean, a lot of people know it just for the snow festival, you know, that you don't really see anywhere else in Japan. It's kind of unique to Hokkaido. Is it, you know, what makes it so unique and different from the rest of the country? I know we kind of touched on a lot of that already, but, you know, what is, I guess, their big selling point that causes more tourists to travel over there?
It's funny because it's almost two-pronged, because I think the reason why people go to Hokkaido is almost a separate answer from what truly makes it unique and special. And I think that a lot of the times people go having a different perception of Hokkaido, and then when they get there, they uncover something completely different. So a lot of the tourist draws to Hokkaido do tend to be kind of more the winter sports direction, or that kind of nature draw, you know, the hiking and all of the kind of water sports activities that you can do during the summertime are, you know, another huge draw. But I think what makes Hokkaido so truly unique and special is that there is this completely separate culture there, which is the culture of the indigenous Ainu people. And I think that's what makes Hokkaido truly, truly special. They, you know, are still very much present in many different places throughout Hokkaido, and you can go to many areas, you know, from Akanmashu to the Shikotsutoya area and in between, and find, you know, still museums and villages and, you know, dedications to their culture. And I think the identity of Hokkaido is a concept that they practice, which is Kyose, you know, that kind of coexistence or symbiosis that you can find in Hokkaido, this real relationship with the natural world and a belief in protecting it and preserving it. And I think it really is a great jumping off point for anyone who's interested in seeing a very authentic side of Japan in a sustainable way. You know, here is a destination that we have the opportunity, when, you know, travel opens back up, to travel better and to do better by the places that we visit. And Hokkaido is an easy place to do that because you have so many indigenous tour guides that are operating where you can give back to the local communities with your, you know, travel dollars and really learn their authentic culture in a respectful way and in a celebratory way. And I think that's just such a important feature in a destination, I think, especially going forward. So yeah, I think that's one of the things that makes Hokkaido special.
Yeah, no, definitely it does.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you about, which was the indigenous Ainu people and how you can like still see parts of this culture today, which I think you've answered it and wonderfully. You mentioned tour guides, and I believe you mentioned some museums. Where are those museums? Do you know?
Sure, yes. So one of the great areas to go to is the Akanmashu National Park. This is where you can find the Akanko Aino Kotan. And this is not far from Lake Akan, and they have a couple of different things there. First of all, you can go on forest tours that are led by indigenous guides, and even English-speaking indigenous guides, who will take you through the forest and show you Hokkaido as it's meant to be experienced, or as it has always been kind of treasured. And they'll introduce, you know, the really important facets of their culture, namely things like kamui, which would be, it's kind of a very broad term for the divine spirits or nature spirits. It encompasses a whole lot of things, but they show you basically how you can trek through the many national parks of Hokkaido in a respectful way and in a way that celebrates nature. And then you can, from there, go on to other places in and around Lake Akan, like the Ainu Theater, where you can see, you know, traditional Ainu dances. They do some modern dance interpretations that utilize like video to be sort of like more immersive experience. But they also showcase a lot of the more traditional aspects of their ceremonial dance. And you can learn about, you know, so many different things about their culture, everything from the artwork that they would create with their like wood carvings to the songs that they sing. There's just so many facets. Another place that you can go to would be the Shikotsutoya area of Hokkaido, which is close to Noboribetsu. And this is another place that you can kind of see some Ainu culture as well. And that's not far from the Nibutani Museum. So there's, I believe actually in Shikotsutoya, their museum is called Upopoi. And if I remember correctly, that it means to sing with a large group, or sing, like lift your voices up as a group. And it's the Ainu language. So you'll see a lot of areas that are named after Ainu language. Things like Furano was taken from an Ainu word as well. It really permeates throughout the prefecture. There are a lot of different, even in Sapporo, you can find museums for Ainu culture.
Then there you go, Nigel. You wanted to go Hokkaido for Ainu people then culture. So there you go.
So now, I didn't have the slightest idea that there was that much to offer for learning about the Ainu people.
I know, that was so much.
Yeah. So that is absolutely amazing. And if I go to Hokkaido and I don't see anything dealing with Ainu, then like it's my fault, you know, because it's so much to offer. You know, but that's absolutely amazing. So, and to know that, you know, the culture and the heritage, the language, these things are being preserved. And as a small follow-up, I don't want to get us too sidetracked, but do you know how COVID-19 affected the Ainu community?
I don't know how it affected the Ainu community directly. I do know that for a while Hokkaido was having a tougher time dealing with, they had some state of emergencies that were declared, I believe in 2020, around this time, I think was when it was not doing as well. But it seems like things have really picked up in terms of the vaccine rollout. And now I think they may actually be doing better than us percentage-wise in terms of the vaccinated population. But I don't know specifically how it impacted the Ainu. To my knowledge, haven't seen any documents that have followed that closely. And it may still be something that's yet to be seen. We're not fully out of this 100%. So it may be something that we would have to look forward to in, you know, the coming years to see the actual data on that.
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. And one other thing, not a COVID-19 related topic, but you had mentioned language and the preservation of the language and whatnot. The written language itself, do they borrow characters, or is it their own unique, completely isolated, not isolated, but separate language from Japanese, like the actual spoken Japanese?
It is their own separate language.
Okay.
It is. It's not a dialect or anything of Japanese. It is its own language.
Completely separate. Cool.
Yes.
We enjoy language talk over here.
Yes, I do as on the well. Podcast.
So it's always interesting to hear about that.
Yeah,
I do as well. I do believe, unfortunately, that it is a dead language now. I remember studying it. It is. There is so much preservation work going on, though, to keep that language alive as much as possible. And, you know, I studied linguistics in university, so I do have this thing for dead and dying languages, and it hits me so hard to think that a language can disappear like that. But we have seen languages come back from being dead languages. And essentially it's just, to my knowledge, clarified as, you know, there's no native speakers still living for whom, for example, the Ainu language is their first language. So this is obviously something that can be changed. You know, with enough work and enough dedication, which they are really putting in so much effort to preserving that language tradition, they could bring it back feasibly in the future. So I really hope that that's the case. But again, it's a challenge to bring back a language like that.
Well, hopefully they do. I mean, that'd be really cool to see it bounce back. I just, in general, like you said, especially when it's a piece of that culture that's unique to them. I mean, it's really hard to lose a part of that. I mean, I feel like it's part of the identity that goes with it when you lose that language.
Absolutely. But there is just a vibrant community of Ainu that are so set on preserving all of their culture. And it is, to my knowledge, an oral tradition, which is why they have so many songs and dances. And that's a lot of the way that they pass things down. There may be written. I don't know enough about the Ainu language myself, but I do know that a lot of the stories that they have are passed down orally.
There we go. We got a topic for a future episode. We got to dig in and learn some more. Now I'm super curious.
Yeah. I feel like we need to round up all the polyglots on the internet, you know?
Yeah, bring them on the podcast. You know.
Yes, please. I would hate to think I'm spouting the wrong facts here. So again, I am by no means an expert on the Ainu language at all. This is just the things that I've, you know, encountered and heard and been told and seen through news articles.
That's cool though. Thank you for sharing that information. I again, I'm just not familiar with it, so it's cool to hear a little bit about it and kind of pique my interest to go do my own, you know, digging around and find out some more information.
Yeah, same.
But I will swing us back into a little bit of a tourism mode here. You know, we talked about earlier, winter is you know, it's brutal. Really frigid and cold in Hokkaido. So. And it's very well known for winter sports and winter outdoor activities. You know, we've already talked about the Sapporo Snow Festival. We talked about skiing and whatnot. But maybe, and you had mentioned this briefly about like the ice floats. But what other, you know, notable climate and nature aspects of Hokkaido are there? You know, we kind of touched a glance on here and there as we were kind of touching on the various areas of Hokkaido. But maybe this is an opportunity to kind of highlight a couple of those.
Sure. And do you want to go like through all the seasons or?
Yeah, let's all do right. it.
Awesome. Well, I think, you know, we'll start off with winter. it is definitely colder and does see a lot of snowfall and is really great. Not just for, you know, skiing and snowboarding, but you can do really cool activities like snowshoeing and even doing a what do they call that when the dogs sledding? There we go.
All right.
Dog sledding. There we go.
They have dog sledding?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It's really cool. And you can do ice fishing too, which is another
I was
really
about
cool
to ask
one.
About that. I was about to ask is ice fishing is actually like a hobby as well, cuz I know I always compare Hokkaido to like Minnesota.
I can see that.
Yeah. Like when people ask like, oh, what's he, you know, like, or when I was in Minnesota, I'd like for work, I would tell them like, oh yeah. Like when I was living over there, they have like Hokkaido is basically your winter is like kind of similar. Mm-hmm. It's just really cold. You stay inside. I mean, you can go outside too, but it's just really, really cold and snowy.
I do remember actually seeing, and I feel like this is a very Minnesota thing. I do remember seeing images that we had of people tossing their coffee into the air in near a Lake Akan and that it freezes in the air. And that seems to me a very Minnesota thing that you could just toss your coffee up and it freezes almost instantly.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. So it does get quite cold in some places for sure. But in the spring, ski season actually extends quite longer than most other places in Japan. So you can actually have it skiing up until early May.
Whoa, early May.
I know. Yeah, and that would be in the, you know, upper elevations. But it also coincides with the very start of cherry blossom season in Hokkaido. So you could be up in the higher elevations in the mountains and have, you know, a ski and then come down to the cities, you know, like Sapporo, and the cherry blossoms are in bloom. So it's a really interesting weather mix.
That is pretty insane to see snow one minute and then cherry blossoms the next.
Mm-hmm. So, that would be the definite tail end of the ski season for Hokkaido. And then, of course, when you go into spring, you have, beautiful cherry blossoms. Odori Park in Sapporo is a great place to see them. In Hakodate, the Goryokaku Park that we were talking about earlier is another absolutely stunning place to see the cherry blossoms. And then when you go up in that tower, you have this bird's eye view of that beautiful star shape, but it's just covered in pink. So it's really, really beautiful. There are plenty of other places to go see flowers, including, of course, Furano, which is really well known for lavender, and that, you know, take us into the summer. And July is a great time to go for the lavender. And it's also a great place to kind of beat the heat, because July and August can be quite hot and humid for central Japan. So a lot of people will run away to Hokkaido, and to the other mountainous areas in Japan to kind of escape that humidity. So Hokkaido is a great summer destination. If you find yourself in Japan during the summertime and you want to kind of get away from the heat a little bit, go to Hokkaido. And, of course, you have so many national parks to choose from. So you have a lot of places to hike. You can hike, caldera lakes and beautiful gorges and valleys. Daisetsuzan National Park is a really stunning place to do some hiking. Songkyo Gorge in Daisetsuzan is absolutely stunning. And there's a lot of waterfalls in that area as well. So you really have a lot of choices. And again, the areas around like Shikotsutoya National Park are great for doing some kayaking on the lakes, or you can do a boat tour. I think for the summer, it's really good to kind of get out and see that greenery. To the east, which we haven't covered so much yet, you have, in addition to Akamashu, you have Kushiro, which is a marshland. And there's some beautiful waterways that kind of snake through that marshland. So you can kind of wander through that area or even take a hot air balloon ride over the marshland, which is really, really gorgeous. And it's just so green and very, very pretty. They also have a lot of, it's great for bird watchers, and particularly things like hawks and eagles. There's a lot of kind of like seahawks and eagles that you'll find on the coast near Nemuro. That's a great kind of bird watching area. And
let's turn to a football chat again. Seahawks and Eagles.
Nice. Yeah, right.
Of course, that was on your mind, Doug.
Sorry.
And I think, any of the places that are great for hiking during the summer are also absolutely stunning in the fall. You see the colors change a lot earlier than you would for central Japan, probably about more like September. And again, Songkyo Gorge is beautiful for that. I think also circling back to wintertime, that Kushiro area is where you're going to see those migrations of Japanese cranes. And they're there during the wintertime, and you can even see them doing like mating dances. And so it is a huge area for wildlife photographers. And they also go to that area for the Ezo deer, which is a Hokkaido endemic species of deer, along with a specific type of squirrel as well, you can find in and around that area. And then kind of if you go up northward towards the Shirotoko Peninsula, you have like more brown bears. I mean, you can find those throughout the prefecture, but there's a lot of brown bears around the Shirotoko Peninsula. And that's part of those wildlife tours that they do, where they kind of hug the coastline in boats so you can see the bears from a safe distance, because a lot of times they're kind of going out from there. And a lot of those lakes have things like sockeye salmon, so you can really see a good amount of bears. Yeah.
There's so a lot. It sounds like there's a lot to do for everyone. So like there's something for everyone in Hokkaido. Like absolutely. There's no complaining.
No, it's not allowed. There's a sign.
I actually believe there is, because it sounds absolutely unreal, you know, just how much there is to offer. And I mean, I feel like I would be willing to say most people when they visit Japan, it's not their like intuition to go to Hokkaido. Yeah, is that correct?
I think you're right about that. I think people are getting a little bit more curious now about Hokkaido because there's been that pull for skiing and snowboarding enthusiasts. And I think Australia kind of led the way a little bit in terms of bringing more attention to areas like Niseko and Kiroro, which are really popular for skiing. And since they've got the opposite seasons, it's like perfect for them to kind of go to Hokkaido during the wintertime and ski. So since then, it's been kind of popping up on people's radars, and where they may not have ever considered Hokkaido before, this winter sports experience has kind of been a gateway to bring a lot more Americans as well to visit Hokkaido. And then once they're there, they see just how much there is. And I have a few friends who went for snowboarding, and they told me, I have to go back. And I don't even know if I'm going to go back for snowboarding. I think I'm just going to go back and do all of the things that I wish I had more time to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even, at this point, I don't even know what I want to do anymore. If I go, it's like,
there's so much. Yeah. There's so much to do.
So much amazing things. And one of the things that really stands out from what you're telling us is also just how much nature there is, you know, to actually explore and, you know, just, and learn about. And so that kind of leads me to one of the things I was thinking about, which is Hokkaido is one of the, it's the largest prefecture, but at the same time, it's one of the least developed, you know, parts of Japan. There's all of this nature to explore. So how does, you know, how does its capital, Sapporo, play a role in the development of Hokkaido?
I think one of the reasons that it's not quite as developed, I guess you'd say, is a little bit owing to that kind of mentality of coexistence. And, you know, the nature in Hokkaido is so, so, so stunning. And I think that there are so many people, even outside of the Ainu culture, that want to preserve that and to celebrate it. And it is just sort of like untamed and wild and beautiful. I couldn't imagine, you know, somebody carving a freeway through, you know, Daisetsuzan National Park or something like that. I think that Sapporo plays a part in kind of the development, in the sense of, you know, it's a place for commerce. It's a place for business. That kind of shopping opportunity and fine dining and hotels are setting up shop there and things like that. But more often I'm actually seeing new properties that are popping up in areas where they're actually trying to work within the natural environment. You know, new ski resorts that are popping up that are kind of a ski in, ski out sort of operation. I think it's the Park Hyatt Niseko Hanazono that just opened up a year or so ago. And they tried to, I think, work within the area around it to be a little bit less disruptive. But again, I think that there is still kind of this desire to keep a lot of it untouched. And because a lot of it is national parkland, they are
I kind of imagine it like if I, not if, when I take this trip to Hokkaido, Sapporo would kind of really kind of be the base that you like, you anchor there and then maybe travel to these other places, you know, and then you go to Furano, you know, or some of the other places to offer.
Yeah, I think that it depends. If you're going to do, you know, southern Hokkaido, you know, Hakodate would probably be your hub instead, which Hakodate does also have very much a city vibe as well. And if you're kind of doing more of a branching out into central and kind of moving eastern, easterly, into other parts of Hokkaido, then maybe Sapporo could be a nice base because they do have some, you know, train lines and bus lines. A lot of places, you know, you can't reach by train. So it is going to be by bus or by car. So if you're wanting to move into areas like Asahikawa, Furano, places like that, then Sapporo could be your base for sure. But you do want to bear in mind that it does, Hokkaido is massive and it does take longer to get to places because there is so many, mountains and places that you can't cut through cleanly. You know, you kind of have to go around and it takes a little bit longer. So I would say don't limit yourself. You know, if you have a good chunk of time to stay in Hokkaido, try to explore some of the other areas. I mean, there's a lot of beautiful hot springs in Hokkaido as well, which we haven't, it's a tragedy. We haven't started talking about hot springs yet, but there are a lot of hot springs that you can stay at as well. That would be, you know, a beautiful experience to have in a traditional Japanese inn. You know, places like Noboribetsu are really famous for that. So I would say, you know, do a little bit of both. Have a kind of a city hub that you use to kind of do shorter day trips, but also don't hold back from kind of staying in those more rural areas as well.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. And no, for, I don't think any more hot springs because I don't know if we can emotionally take it at this point without being able to visit it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine Hokkaido would be a great place for hot springs just because, like, when I think of hot springs, like, I would think of, you know, going to the hot spring during the cold season, and Hokkaido is, like, the perfect setting for that. So I would imagine Hokkaido is, like, a big hot spring destination.
Yeah. And they have so much volcanic activity that it is a little bit more of a unique relationship between the people and the hot springs and the volcanoes. There's kind of this unique view of a give and a take, kind of. And they do use the minerals that can be found, you know, in and around those kind of more active volcanoes and in the mineral hot springs themselves, and use them for health benefits. So a lot of them are great for things like blood circulation, arthritis, skin conditions, things like that. So I like to see this real coexistence with nature culture that, you know, not just the Ainu, but anyone who has lived their life in Hokkaido has really made a significant part of their identity. And the hot springs are no different. It's just, it kind of goes through everything. And that Noboribetsu area, which is not far from Lake Toya, I think, if I remember rightly, they get something like 10,000 gallons of water a day from the hot springs that, like, filter down into all of the different resorts and baths that they have there. So it's a massive amount, and that's just one hot spring area in Hokkaido. So yeah.
Well, speaking of different destinations and hot springs, you know, like I've said in the beginning of this episode, you know, none of us have sadly been to Hokkaido yet, but, you know, it's on our to-do list. And of course, when you have a travel to-do list, when it comes to Japan, a lot of the times it's like these attractions or destinations that we really want to go see or do. And I know for me, you covered some of it, but not all of it for me, because I personally, on my to-do list for Hokkaido, I do want to go to Sapporo because I want to go to Odori Park. But specifically, I don't know, I have this weird thing about TV towers. And I just, like, I went to Tokyo Tower and that was fun. I've been to Kyoto Tower. That was fun. And I'm like, I want to try the TV tower in Sapporo.
Yeah.
Tower Otaku.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, it's iconic for sure. You can't miss it. It's a very iconic tower. And the area around it is so pretty, no matter the season.
It looks pretty. Every time I see pictures or videos, I'm like, man, I just want to take a good stroll in the park.
And that's exactly what it's for. It's the perfect place to have a stroll. And there's lots of little, you know, shops around and even stalls that are kind of selling foodstuffs. And underneath a part of Odori Park is a 500-meter-long art gallery. So you can actually go underneath and walk through this beautiful art gallery and see a lot of local contemporary artwork.
Oh, cool.
So I don't know. Odori Park has a lot. And they've got just tons of activities throughout the year. So you have everything from like jazz festivals to, it hosts, of course, the Sapporo Snow Festival. There's, you know, what is it? There's a summer festival that happens there. I think it is the Soran Festival.
Oh, I would want to go to that, because the whole point of like my destinations is I would go in the summer because I'm a wimp and I can't handle the cold. So as much as I would love to see the snow festival, like that's just, let's reality check for me. It's just never going to happen, honestly. So to know that there's something going on during the summer, that's just great for me. Yay.
Definitely.
Is that like the Soran, is that like the Yosokoi, like dancing?
Yes,
so cool.
I know, right? I want to go see it now. But like, because another destination of mine is best seen during the summer, and that is Farm Tomita. Just the beautiful flowers, the pictures look so amazing. I just want to go.
And you can't forget the lavender soft serve either.
Oh, I know. I saw that and I was like, ooh, ice cream.
Right? And it's not just lavender. They grow other wildflowers there as well. So it's like this really beautiful kind of patchwork quilt of like different wildflowers. And it is really, really beautiful. During the summertime, they do actually run special trains. That will go directly from Sapporo to Furano or from Asahikawa. So it gets easier during the summertime to go to some of those places.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Well, I know Torano, that is one of your destinations, right, Nigel?
Yeah. So I don't know if I didn't even really realize that I preferred summer, but now I'm seeing I do, because the lavender is high on my list. That's like a bucket list thing for me. Like I have to see those lavender fields before I die. It just has to happen. So I guess I have to go in the summer as well. But another thing that's on my list is also the Noboribetsu Onsen. So Kay, you talked about that, and it just increased it like tenfold, you know, the amount of desire I have to go there as well.
There's another summer festival for that area too.
See, well, I was going to ask you, what's the best time? Would it be the winter, so you get the cold effect going to an onsen, or would it be better in the summer?
Well, I think you might want to try the summer because you can do the Demon Fireworks Festival.
So
that sounds awesome.
It is really cool because the whole area surrounding Noboribetsu is, or within Noboribetsu is this area called Jigokudani or Hell Valley. So Hokkaido has its own Hell Valley. I think a lot of people are familiar with the Jigokudani in Nagano, where you can see the snow monkeys. But there's another Jigokudani in Hokkaido. And it's if you go into Noboribetsu, you'll see, which I believe the statue is Yukijin. And it's this big, gigantic demon statue. Only it's supposed to be a protecting demon. So this festival, fireworks festival that they have during the summer is kind of like a protection thing. And a bunch of Yukijin, people dressed up as demons, will line the streets. And then they have handheld firework launchers that they launch fireworks up into the air. It's this really spectacular display. So I think maybe summer might be your thing.
I think I'm just going to move it. I think that's what's going to happen. Everything this episode is just it's just steering me towards, you know, I'm just going
to pack now up. I need to go to Noboribetsu. Like, what? Yeah. That's amazing.
It should be June 2 through the end of July, I think, is when you can see those festival displays. Gosh.
I'm going.
Yeah, I know, right? And I think the last thing that, like, if you had a big three that's on my list, doesn't really depend on the season, and that is in Sapporo. I've heard that there's a ramen alley.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, it's a strip of a street where there's all these famous ramen shops that have been. I think the street has been around for something around 50 years, where it's become kind of known as Ramen Alley. But I'm sure it existed long before. But that is high on my list. Have you heard of that, Kay?
Yes, yes. And I've gotten to go. It's really fun. It's Ramen Yokocho. Wow. And yeah, they do have, I think it's something like 17 different ramen shops just in that little alleyway. And they specialize a lot in miso ramen. But of course, you know, you can also find other places that you can get the Sapporo ramen, and that'll have kind of the butter and the corn in the ramen, which is really, really, really tasty. And you could just find buttered corn and like buttered potatoes in Hokkaido, just in little food stalls on the streets and stuff. But, Ramen Yokocho. And I think if I'm not mistaken, it's in Susukino, because it's not far off from kind of the hustle and bustle of that main drag. And, there's a big kind of intersection, but yeah, it's not terribly difficult to find. I definitely recommend going. And if you do go during the wintertime, what better way to kind of warm up than having a nice hot bowl of miso ramen? So yeah, that's a good one.
I'm just sold.
So Nigel, you and I, we're going to go into a ramen coma, right? Like, oh my gosh. Just eat all the ramen.
Yeah. I don't know. Gosh, don't even get me started. What about you, Doug?
Yeah, well, you guys are, while you're eating ramen, I'm going to be at the Sapporo Brewery checking that out.
Of course.
I know, I'm going to sound like the alcoholic here.
You and your alcohol.
but no, like Sapporo Brewery, honestly, one of my favorite beers. When I first got to Japan, I think I drank Sapporo a lot more than Kirin or Asahi. Maybe drink Asahi more now when I go over there. But Sapporo is my first big, I guess, beer crush while I was over there. And then there's another one, Otokoyama Sake Brewery.
I love Otokoyama. It's one of the sakes that's my favorite.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I've never had it, but I've heard you know, just so many good things about it. And there's something about cold weather and sake that just, I don't know, it does it for me.
I feel that.
Yeah, it just, it's like something about just the atmosphere or the environment. I don't know. It just, it's a good pairing, cold weather and sake. So, you know, those would be kind of my two. Obviously, they're not really close by each other. It's a bit of a trip, but. A
little bit.
yeah, just a little. And then the other one we kind of touched on a lot earlier, the Nibutani Ainu Culture Museum. Mm-hmm. I, again, was interested in learning more about that. And I'm curious, the museum, have you actually been before?
Or... I've not been to the Nibutani, no.
Okay. I'm curious if they have like verbiage or pamphlets or stuff in English as well as like Japanese and, you know, other, I don't know, like what languages, maybe Russian would probably be
a lot there too, since it's so close to Russia. Right. You know, I feel like
it's surprising. A lot of these museums, even in areas that are more rural, do tend to have a good array of pamphlets in different languages. So I would definitely say I would expect at least English, Mandarin, and Korean to be the languages that you would probably see just about anywhere that you go. There is a really high amount of Chinese tourists that will visit Hokkaido and Tohoku as well. It's become really popular, especially during the winter season. So I would not be surprised to find a good amount of English language pamphlets.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because that was, I feel like that is going to be a barrier for a lot of tourists traveling in Japan from the U.S. or other English-speaking countries. Is just if you don't have a grasp on Japanese, the further you get out of the big cities into these smaller, more rural areas, the less like language accessibility you may have. So, you know, obviously that may be a concern for some folks. And me personally, I would be interested in it, especially if they had it in English, because I can actually read the background and the history on the things that they're displaying or talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the smaller museums that I've been to in rural areas have always had English pamphlets, you know, going to like the Nebuta Museum in Aomori, and they've got, you know, English language signage even throughout the museum. So I would say it's a good bet. Having not been there myself, I can't say 100%, but I would be surprised if they didn't.
Okay, cool.
Going back to the Sapporo Brewery, because we definitely can't gloss over that.
I know I did, right? I just kind of like, yeah, Sapporo.
Well, because you didn't want to seem like a drunk, you said.
No. One of my favorite things about the Sapporo Brewery, though, is the Genghis Khan barbecue restaurant that is attached to the brewery itself. And you go in and cook. It's like a cook your own barbecue type of situation.
I need to go on mute. Hang on.
They do the kind of the lamb or the mutton grilled meat, and you can do crab, and you know there's a bunch of vegetables too for people who don't eat meat, and you can get a lot of Sapporo beer variations that you can only find in Hokkaido.
Wow,
that are not available anywhere else in Japan even. So it is a good time, and you can sit, you know, have beer after beer, enjoy the barbecue. And, you know, just come off of that tour on a high note.
So I think the question is, are we moving as soon as Japan opens up? Or like, are we giving it a little time first?
As long as I get close to that barbecue, it sounds good.
Right. Know, it right? is.
And is there a hospital so close to that?
Right, that's really good.
I think they had to roll me out when I ate there. It was just so good. You can't stop.
I just ate dinner and now I'm like hungry again. And we haven't even got to the food section of this of the topic. It's crazy.
Well, speaking of food, because as you can tell, the three of us, we love our food.
I think we did this last time.
yeah. I don't know if listeners kind of noticed, but you did mention how, like, you know, we talked about how dairy plays a big part in Hokkaido, and you just mentioned corn and potatoes, which are my jam. But you know, what are some must-try foods in Hokkaido area? Like, what are they known for, and like, what should people like really go out and seek?
Sure, that's a good one, and there are a lot. One I think that is particularly good, and if you are somebody who enjoys fresh seafood, it is an absolute must, is to do a kaisendon, or the seafood bowl. I just, no shade to any other coastal areas of Japan, which is pretty much the whole country, but Hokkaido just has some of the freshest seafood because the water up there is just so icy cold. So you really do have incredible seafood, and those morning markets are a great place to try them out. But one in particular that surprised even me was sea urchin. Sea urchin in Hokkaido is sweet, It's creamy and almost kind of buttery. It's totally different from I guarantee you, any sea urchin you've had up to this point, which a lot of people turn their nose up at sea urchin because it can have a real bitter flavor to it. And, you know, the texture is not the funnest. And so I think a lot of people give it a pass. If you go to Hokkaido around kind of the just early fall, please try the sea urchin. It will change your life.
That is the only reason my wife wants to go to Hokkaido.
It's for
she doesn't want to go for anything else. She wants to go for the sea urchin only.
That's
I'm not even a big sea urchin person. I'm one of those, I guess, one of those people that turns my nose up to it because I don't know. I just
it's I am too
smell
dumb.
Or
don't
the taste. Bad. I don't know. Maybe it's everything. It looks like earwax.
I'm with you.
I get that. People will always say the earwax thing. And I think I've even thought that myself before.
I didn't know other people said that. I just thought it just looks like that to me. I'm like, ugh.
I think it's just like most people have never really experienced wasabi the way that it's meant to be experienced. You know, most of us were getting horseradish that's been dyed green. And call it wasabi. Whereas like true grated wasabi has a totally different flavor and it's not as harsh. And it's totally the same for sea urchin in Hokkaido. Just throw any notions you have of what sea urchin should taste like out the window. Give it a try. You will be so pleasantly surprised. But aside from that, some of the really delicious produce would be like Ubarde melon. Which it's like candy. Like this is a melon that's really famous throughout Hokkaido. And you'll see often a lot of things that are flavored like Ubarde melon. Like if you buy them in Hokkaido, it's like a good, you know, every prefecture has its kind of signature flavor. And Ubarde melon is really, really, really sweet. I can't explain it. Like you have to just give it a try. That's a definite must. I think that Genghis Khan style barbecue that I talked about, that's another one that's really popular. Of course, you got to do ramen. And Sapporo ramen is a must, but there's also Hakodate ramen, which I think has either a pork or a chicken soup base. So it's kind of a little bit different. I would say definitely try crab for sure. Any seafood in Hokkaido, you really can't go wrong. But another thing is maybe like soup curry. That's another like very Hokkaido type of thing.
I've heard of that. Yeah. I've heard the curry stuff.
I've heard of that too, and I'm a big curry fan. So like
milk curry or something. It's like dairy curry or I don't know. I just heard like some type of.
It really is like a soup curry. Like it's like, you know, kind of the flavors, but more of like the soup consistency. So not quite as thick, and then it's really got kind of a mishmash of. It's not going to be like everything broken down as hard as you might see in like a traditional Japanese curry. You're going to see kind of more of the vegetables and meats represented. But I think they tend to go seasonal with that. So it depends on what's in season at the time. But you can see things like, you know, kabocha, crab, that like mutton meat or wagyu. You can do just about anything in there and it's going to be delicious.
I just want to just go there and just have an eating tour in Hokkaido.
You definitely
I know. That sounds like a good idea. Wow. So for listeners who, and for us, when we move to Hokkaido, you know, let's say we land on the main island, you know, and we want to get to Hokkaido to our home. What is the best way to travel there? If you're coming from mainland Japan, would it be a flight? Would it be a ferry? Or what are some options?
So flight is definitely the quickest. We're talking about quickest and easiest. That 90-minute flight from Tokyo, which honestly most people are going to come through either Haneda or Narita airports, if they're coming from the U.S. at least. If they're doing Inner Asia, New Chitose takes a lot of Asian flights. It is an international airport. Even Hawaii flies direct to New Chitose. So it just depends on where you're coming from. But let's say, you know, you're coming from the continental U.S. A lot of them are going to pass through Tokyo. And in which case, that 90-minute flight is going to be the quickest. And you're probably going to end up on a Japan Airlines flight or like All Nippon Airways, one of the Japanese carriers. And another option is there is the Tohoku or Hokkaido bullet train. And this is a really fabulous option if you're kind of more slow going. If you want to do your Japan Rail Pass and really kind of like work your way northward, that's a great option. It's also one of the routes that gets that ultra luxurious grand class. And it goes all the way from Tokyo to Shin Hakodate Hokuto Station, which is the first and final station stop for the Hokkaido bullet train. From there, you can move outward from Hakodate Station by train and reach Sapporo in about 2 hours. Because it is just the tippy southern tip of Hokkaido. But I say if you want, you know, beautiful views of the Japanese countryside and just work your way northward, you're going to hit some great destinations along the way, you know, as you travel through Tohoku. So it's not going to be a boring ride up to Hokkaido by any means. You're going to, you know, pass through, you know, Tochigi and Fukushima, and you're going to go past Sendai and all these great places that you're going to want to maybe disembark for a bit and kind of take in some rural destinations before you hit Hokkaido. And then Hakodate itself is definitely a destination that you don't want to just pass out of real quickly. There's a lot to do there, and it's so quaint and cute. So I definitely recommend, you know, going on foot and touring the city and seeing those cute markets and going to all those kind of tourism hotspots.
So flying is the quickest way, but not necessarily the best way if you want to really take in all of the sights and see everything.
I think everyone's best is different, you know? Maybe if you're looking to pack as much in as you possibly can, then time is probably not on your side and you want to maybe go the quickest way. But if you have more time to dedicate and you're really kind of wanting to see the Japanese countryside, do that Hokkaido bullet train. Even if you're going to do a straight shot, it's 4 hours from Tokyo to Shin Hakodate Hokuto Station. So, it's not an arduous, you know, journey. You're probably going to be very comfy, especially if you're in that grand class. You know, you can kick your shoes off, put those slippers on, enjoy the butler service along the way, have some drinks and some bento boxes, and you'll be there in a flash, and you can get the next leg of your journey started.
So, you know, one thing you did mention earlier, you mentioned the art gallery that was underground. Is there like a lot of like, and I like, this is kind of coming back to my comparison to Minnesota. You know, I used to work a lot in Rochester, Minnesota, and they had kind of in the city center, kind of like underground, like kind of things connecting all the buildings and stuff. So you didn't have to go out into the cold to get from point A to point B. Sometimes you would be able to, go between. Is there anything like that in Sapporo or any of those, like, I guess, major cities that you're aware of?
Well, I think anywhere that you have, I mean, you can see that in a lot of different places in Japan, because anywhere that you have like a station, there's going to be a lot of parts of it that are going to be underground.
Yeah.
And when they're so expansive, like Susukino Station or Sapporo Station, when they're so expansive like that, you can really get from one section of that area all the way across almost town just by going through those kind of like subway tunnels and stuff. So, you can see that in a lot of different
Yeah.
Places in Japan. Tokyo for sure.
I know Tokyo for sure. Yeah. Tokyo is basically, yeah, you can live underground almost.
Right, exactly. So yeah. I don't know that it's quite necessarily as expansive as Tokyo.
Yeah.
But there, you know, are going to be some elements that are going to be underground. I think there's more shopping as well underneath that kind of like Odori Park area.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think it's just going to be stuff that's connected to stations a lot of the times.
Yeah.
Make it easier to kind of get around. And as always, the big advice to people is pay attention to where you're supposed to exit a station. And definitely exit the correct one, because once you're up and out, man, you're going to find out you're so far from where you're supposed to be.
Is it 1B or 1A door, or...
Right. Well, Kay, you mentioned the Shinkansen being one of the methods to get to Hokkaido, more of the scenic method. And with, you know, mentioning the Shinkansen, you know, I would assume people would possibly do the JR pass when, because just when I think of Shinkansen, I automatically think, okay, I need to buy a JR pass. So if people were to do that, once you get to Hokkaido Prefecture, is train and subway or whatever kind of transportation that you can use for the JR pass, is that feasible for that area? Or like, do they have, because I remember earlier in the episode you were saying how you know, sometimes you have to get a car to get to some places. So I'm just kind of wondering about like just traveling within Hokkaido, what does that look like?
Well, there are a lot of the lines that are operating are going to be JR Hokkaido lines. So you should be good with that, because it covers anything on the JR network. But I would say with Hokkaido, more than any other place in Japan, it's best to really look up the operation information, because a lot of lines go in and out of service depending on the season. So where you might see some summer trains that are operating, those may not be operational during the winter time. So it's best to kind of stay on top of how you're going to get from point A to point B depending on when you're traveling to Hokkaido. But the JR Hokkaido website has great information on that. So I would say a JR pass is still good for getting around Hokkaido. And there are some JR buses as well. I'm not sure how many are in operation in Hokkaido specifically, but JR does also offer buses. So it's just going to depend. And then I would say also look into, if you're going to make Hokkaido the main kind of stay in during your trip to Japan, then I would look into Hokkaido specific tourism vouchers and options, because there are things like the JR Hokkaido specific pass. So you may find that you don't need to go fully JR pass if you're not going to do that long, you know, train trip. If you are, for example, just going to fly into Hokkaido, then there are some Hokkaido specific transit passes that are available. And you can either go to like Good Day Hokkaido's website, which that's the tourism board of, or the tourism website for Hokkaido. Sapporo has its own as well. And those are great resources. I love using them honestly in my own day to day, because a lot of times things, you know, change. There can be some weather event and things go out of service for a period of time, and it's a good resource to kind of stay on top of all of that.
Yeah, that's
good to know.
Yeah, that's good to know. Like, was that Good Day Hokkaido you said?
Mm-hmm. Good Day Hokkaido. Okay. And then the Sapporo tourism website is just Welcome to Sapporo, and that's sapporo.travel. is their website.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. All our listeners out there got all the spicy news on where to check out for your transit needs. But before we kind of are approaching the end of our questions for you, picking your brain. But before we wrap up, I wanted to see if you had any other, you know, we've touched on a lot
during this whole talk. But do you have maybe any other advice that maybe is a must know before you head to Hokkaido for a trip that we haven't talked about already?
I would just say probably the best thing that you could do is really think about what it is that you want from a destination, and that'll help kind of inform you of what season is going to meet those needs probably the best, because Hokkaido is different season to season. It's a different animal completely. So I would say it's a good destination to kind of do your research ahead of time. And, you know, keep that seasonality in mind, especially if you're traveling around times like the Sapporo Snow Festival. That's really going to impact hotel availability. It can be just impossible to get a hotel if you're that close to the snow festival. So keeping kind of those key dates in mind when you're planning is great. But just, I say, pick your season and then really use those tourism resources. You can use our website, which is just japan.travel. We've got a great bit of information on all the different areas of Hokkaido, because again, they are so different from north to south, east to west. And use, you know, Good Day Hokkaido, use Sapporo.travel to help you kind of find things that suit your interests. And then I would just say also, remember that Hokkaido is just so huge and you don't have to pack everything into one trip. This is a destination that begs to be visited again and again for different things. So don't try to stretch yourself too thin. It can be hard to, you know, hit everything all in one go because it is so spread out. So I would say pick a region, or, you know, pick one or two, and then really focus your energies on those areas. And then if you go back to Hokkaido again, you know, then maybe you do the east instead of the south, and you'll find that it's a lot easier to really enjoy the destination when you're not having to, you know, basically cross the whole prefecture just to get to a thing you're gonna do for half the day. You don't want to, and that's my rule of thumb really for the whole country. People really get excited, and they kind of look at Japan as like a once in a lifetime destination, but it doesn't have to be. It is such an easy destination to travel to. So you're better off not spreading yourself too thin and really trying to go hard on that first time in to Hokkaido and do it all. Cause who knows, you know, I would just say, try to really savor the places that you're in and give yourself enough time for transit, enough time to stop and enjoy it while you're there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think that was a great, great thing to end on. And of course, for those of you who maybe didn't catch it, all of the sites that Kay mentioned, we'll put them in the description link for this episode of the podcast for sure, to definitely help you, you know, get your travel itinerary for Hokkaido done. I know us crew, we're gonna start doing that travel itinerary for Hokkaido, right,
well,
guys?
Well, it's also gonna be helpful for you, like, you know, just day-to-day living there when we are living there. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Oh gosh, I can only imagine Nigel living in Hokkaido, and we see him and he's like, hey guys, you know, I'm just gonna be right here, there's background of snow, and oh gosh, I can
no, his background's gonna be Ramen Alley.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, Ramen Alley. Yeah.
Ramen Alley
in the lavender, of course.
Yes.
And so the hospital, of course.
Would this be the wrong time to mention that the National Park Service has also been working on expanding Wi-Fi so more people can work remotely?
There you go.
This would be the wrong time.
Oh, wow. There you
definitely
go.
Not the right time to mention that, of course. But
my boss doesn't need to know I'm working remote from Hokkaido.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, now there's virtual backgrounds. You could just be wherever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right, right.
Take a picture of my office.
Yeah, you've opened a Pandora's box, Kay. I don't know if it can be closed now. So.
I hope they aren't listening.
I know. Let's, yeah.
Dun.
I'm not here.
No one said anything.
But yeah, no, thank you so much, Kay, for joining us for this episode. You were a pleasure to have on season one, and we were so lucky to get you again for this Hokkaido episode. We really appreciate all your advice and your just enthusiasm about Hokkaido. We really, really enjoyed this episode.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me back again. It's always fun to come and gush about different destinations that people may not have visited before. That is my bread and butter and the thing that makes me happy every day. So thank you.
All right. Are you sold? I know we are. Thanks for joining us on an amazing journey. Today, we talked about Hokkaido with Kay Allen from Japan Travel, also known as the Japan National Tourism Organization. We hope you learned a lot about Hokkaido and are ready to add it to your itinerary on your next trip to Japan. I know we are, or maybe we're even moving there. We don't know yet. But nevertheless, whether it is traveling, it's the culture and history of the Ainu people, whether it's exploring the nature, the festivals, or exploring the sake breweries or beer breweries or a Genghis Khan barbecue place. There's something for everybody in Hokkaido. And we hope that you got a little bit of taste of that in this episode with Kay Allen. We're so thankful to Kay for joining us today and to Japan Travel and to you, our listener. Be sure to give us a follow on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. We're at Crew of Japan. That's K-R-E-W-E-O-F. J-A-P-A-N podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. That's it for today, and until next time.